You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
I run into coincidences all the time. Take this episode, for example. The day after this episode drops in our regular feed, I will finally actually visit the subject of this research. Karen used to live near the San Jose estate of Sarah Winchester, but I've never quite made it out there, and I'm excited to finally check this off my paranormal bucket list. But that's kind of the thing, isn't it? Is there anything actually paranormal about this place? Is it really the physical manifestation in real estate form of a woman's lifelong struggle with oppressive spirits? And is it bad storytelling if I remind you that our show is all about trying to find out what's really going on? Karen's book, Haunting America, was probably the first place I ever read the true story of what was really behind the San Jose, California estate of Sarah Winchester. Check our show notes for links to her book and some of the other resources that are mentioned in this show. We've talked about this topic in a few of our episodes, but I believe this is our first dedicated deep dive into the real history of the Winchester Mystery House.
Monster Talk.
So I gathered you guys here today to talk about the Winchester Mystery House. Now, Matt has visited the place before with me, and Blake, I'm not sure if you've been there or not.
No. I think the closest I've come is I got into San Francisco, and I think that was about it.
Good effort. Well, good effort, though.
It's close enough, yeah. And I guess that's on the bucket list then someday.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Although not for the supernatural reasons. Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because when I went there with Karen, the bulk, I think, of the investigation and the research hadn't actually been done yet, because this was a chapter for her book, Haunting America, which I highly recommend if you have not read it and purchased it and given a review on Amazon.
Thanks for the plug.
But, I'll just say I'm not her husband, but I also recommend the book.
Oh, cool.
So there you go.
The interesting thing is I went into it with the perspective of the supernatural stuff really, you know, is not true. But what is just accepted is that she believed in the supernatural and she went a little crazy. And that was kind of the accepted sort of skeptical view on this whole thing. And that's what I went in and finding out I'm completely wrong. So it's a fun story.
Yeah, it is. And I agree with you that that was the party line for skeptics at the time. We're going to go into the folklore and the legends here in a minute. The tours are interesting too, and we'll talk about that. But anyway, so for Blake getting to San Francisco, he was pretty close. But the mystery house is in San Jose. I became interested in the place going back to about 2004 when I moved to the States, because I was speaking with a colleague and she said, oh, you're interested in spooky stuff and the paranormal. Have you been to the Winchester Mystery House? And I said, no, I'd seen lots of big posters and road signs and things like that to the place. And upon looking into it, realized it was a place I'd seen on TV when I was a kid on an episode of Ripley's Believe It or Not. So they'd shown the place and they'd spoken about the door to nowhere. And I was fascinated with that as a kid.
This was back when it was the Jack Palance hosted version.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yes. Yes. So I was always determined to visit the place when I grew older, and I did. And I've been there a number of times now. And certainly the first time I went as well, I believe in all of the stories that they told there. I mean, I guess we're going to get into this shortly anyway. So we'll just start, I think, with the folklore. But there's also some history in this too, because we're talking about people who did exist and going back to the 19th century. All of these stories surround a woman named Sarah Winchester. I believe she was born Sarah Lockwood Pardee. And so she's portrayed as this deeply superstitious and obsessive and paranoid, crazy woman in all the stories that are told on the tour. And if you look up the place online, this is pretty much the party line that you're going to hear. So she
line.
Was born in New Haven, Connecticut in 1839. And in 1862, she married a fellow by the name of William Wirt Winchester. So we've all heard of the Winchester family. They were the owners of the Winchester Repeating Arms Company. So this was during the height of the American Civil War as well. And we know them very well for having created a particular model, 73, the Winchester Model 73, which was the gun that won the West. So, Blake, I got you to dig into this a little bit more. Guns aren't my thing. You guys have had more experience with this kind of thing.
I've heard the gun that won the West associated with the Winchester 73 repeating rifle. And I've also heard it associated with the Colt Peacemaker. Of course, the Colt Peacemaker is the famous revolver. It's known for that other phrase, God created men and Colonel Colt made them equal. And they sometimes called that pistol the Great Equalizer. But in the past...
Never heard of that before.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're moving those circles.
Yeah. Well, I don't either. I mean, I guess the thing you need to remember about the American Old West is that... first of all, it's not that old. We're talking about, like, you know, from the 1870s to the 1920s. And second of all, it's largely myth. The American Western, both film, radio shows, and fiction, penny novels, that sort of thing, these made mythic stories about the Wild West and frontier justice and that sort of stuff. But it's largely made up. It's largely not a real thing. And when I was trying to, like, run this to ground, like, when did this phrase, and I've heard two versions of it, the gun that won the West and the gun that tamed the West.
I haven't heard that one either.
Yeah. If you go back, it was really popular in the 1950s. And I was kind of trying to run down why. And I kind of went backwards from present day, you know, working my way backwards through history. Around 1950 is when it really becomes a big part of advertising campaigns. And lots of news coverage. And that's because in the year 1950, there was a film made called Winchester 73. It's a really fun Western. I like it a lot, with Jimmy Stewart. And it kind of ties into this marketing campaign that they had. Winchester had wanted to, like, make their guns kind of exclusive. So they would do firing tests on the barrels. And then if a barrel was exceptionally accurate, they would stamp it like, you know, this is 1 in 100. And then if it was really, really accurate, they would call it, this is 1 in 1,000. And they would stamp that on the barrel, and it would give, like, they could charge significantly more. Let's say a rifle costs, you know, a normal rifle costs $25. then these ultra rare variants could be 100. So people would be paying, you know, quite a bit more for these custom barrels. Right. And that's kind of what the movie's about, is like one of these special exclusives. And so these were real, but the campaign only ran for a little while because people realized, well, wait a minute. Instead of seeing it as like, here's this exclusive, and then they've got this middle ground in the 1 in 100, and then they have their regular run, people started saying, well, maybe these regular runs are inferior. And so they stopped the campaign. But in 1948, it was 75 years since the introduction of the Winchester 73. And so that led to lots of news stories about the 75th anniversary of this famous gun. And then, of course, the eponymous Winchester 73 movie. So that really cemented that phrase in people's mind about this being the gun that won the West. But as you can tell, that's significantly far away from the essentially non-existent events. And when I was doing research on this, the Colt pistol kept coming up again and again as well. And the funny thing was, all the gun historians seemed to agree, neither of these guns won the West. That the frontier gun that really did the most yeoman work was the shotgun. That the shotgun by far was the one that settled things, kept your food on the table, and was generally the weapon of choice. So there's a lot of mythology around it, but those two guns are quite famous. They're still manufactured today. And it's funny to me because even the Winchester gun itself, the company, like they effectively went bankrupt in like 32, I think. We went into a lot of debt building guns for World War One. And then they were trying to pay down that debt. They basically, during the peacetime, they converted their factories into making all kinds of household goods and had like Winchester, catalogs, kind of like the Sears catalog. But none of that worked because when the economy tanked during the Great Depression, Winchester was one of the casualties. They couldn't get out of their debt. Even though the company was still making good weapons, they just couldn't make the business work. So the Otis Ammunition Company bought them and continued to own them for quite a while. And I don't want to get into a giant history of this thing, but the main thing is everything you know about the Wild West is basically myth, and it's largely manufactured. And it's just part of the American mythology about the, heroes and villains fighting it to the death in the old West. And that's just largely not true.
Right. And I think with this story about the Winchester Mystery House and Sarah Winchester, that there are a lot of modern day morals which are put onto her and put onto this story too. So I think that that's interesting element that we see playing out throughout the whole story. So I'm going to issue a warning here that I'm going to be talking briefly about pregnancy loss. So if people want to skip over this bit, they can. So we're a part of the story where Sarah Winchester and her husband, William, they have a baby. I believe that she had multiple miscarriages and she finally carried a baby to term. And she was born, her name was Annie Pardee Winchester, and she was born in June 1866. Very sadly, she died the following month. And I believe she had some kind of condition called marasmus, which doesn't seem to be a term that we really use nowadays, but it's some type of protein energy malnutrition. So they were devastated. But then in pretty quick succession after that, her mother died, and then her father-in-law died, Oliver Fisher Winchester. He died the same year. And then her husband died as well in 1881. He was only age 43. He died of tuberculosis. So at this point, she inherits $20 million and a stake in the company too that gave her this continuous income of about $1,000 per day, which equals somewhere in the vicinity of about $26,000 per day today, which is just a staggering amount of money.
Walking around money.
Yeah, it makes me think of Brewster's Millions or something.
Yeah.
So then as the story goes, she's grief-stricken and she decides to visit a psychic in Boston, and his name's Adam Coombs. And he claims that she's cursed by the Winchester fortune, and he calls it blood money. So again, we're kind of putting morals of today onto that time. And he states that she was haunted by the spirits of the people and the animals who died at the hands of a Winchester rifle, and that they were all avenging their deaths by claiming the lives of her family members, and she was next. So here's a quote that's floating around from this psychic. This is coming from her husband. He says, "For me to tell you that there is a curse on your family which took the life of he and your child. It will soon take you too. It is a curse that has resulted from the terrible weapon created by the Winchester family. Thousands of persons have died because of it, and their spirits are now seeking vengeance. You must start a new life and build a home for yourself and for the spirits who have fallen from this terrible weapon too.
So, Blake had already kind of mentioned that the Winchesters didn't create that weapon. They just manufactured one of the ones that was being manufactured.
Yeah, they were partnered with the Browning and Henry, two gunsmiths that really transformed American shooting. And so they were constantly making improvements, but unfortunately there was a lot of patent wars at the time. They kind of got around that by modifying their designs. So when they came up with the 73, it was, I think if I remember correctly, it was somewhat to work around the Henry, the guy who invented the Henry repeater. But I know, I remember Browning made guns for all kinds of people. His gun designer. This was kind of like, you know, Johnny Ive. You've got the designer who's more famous than the company that's making his weapons, you know? It's interesting how many parallels there are around these businesses and sort of the personalities of the people that were making the designs.
So it's like a historical version of the Microsoft Apple rivalry.
Yeah, it reminds me of that. It reminds me of, people would modify, and they still do. There's a big gun modification business out there. You can, people will buy guns and then get aftermarket parts and soup them up, chrome them out. You know, it's like Pimp My Ride or any of those things. It's been going on forever. So, yeah.
You know, it's interesting as well that you've got this psychic that says that the people that were killed by this weapon were basically coming after the family. Mm-hmm. That was the curse. So what was the solution? She had to keep building?
The solution was that she was to move to the West Coast and she was to purchase a home. And she needed to build a house. There are lots of different theories. Some say that she was to build this house for the spirits, for them to live in. And others say that she needed to build this house to confuse the spirits and, I guess, to create a maze where they couldn't find her and kill her. So one of the spirits had said to her, too, as long as you will build, you will live, stop, and you will die. So she moves to the Santa Clara Valley area in around 1884, and she buys a very large block of land, about 161 acres of orchards, and she purchases this 8-bedroom farmhouse, and she
sounds
proceeds
very modest
to build and renovate this house. Very, very modest. So she proceeds to build and renovate this house nonstop, 24/7, over the next 38 years. So if she does stop, then the spirits are going to get her. So this results in her building a remarkable house. It's this sprawling maze-like home with, at the time, 500 rooms, 10,000 windows. These are the statistics that everyone always quotes. 2,000 doors, 52 skylights, 47 stairways and fireplaces, 6 kitchens, 3 elevators and 2 ballrooms. Incredible place. And it has lots of quirky features as well. There's lots of quirky features. There are upside down rail posts and tiny little doors and windows in floors and windows that open onto blank walls and a staircase that leads to a ceiling and a very famous door to nowhere that opens outward to an 8-foot drop. So it's all very opulently decorated too. She's just ordering fine Italian marble and rosewood for her floors. So she has a ton of money, and boy, is she really spending it too. So,
you know, they missed an opportunity though. They call it the Winchester Mystery House, but when she was alive, she could have called it the Tortured Orchard.
There you go.
See, that would have.
Indeed, yeah. So obviously at the time she didn't call it the Winchester Mystery House.
She did
that
not.
Would be kind of strange.
Yeah.
But we'll get into that soon. But there are some strange features. there's a recurring motif of spiders throughout the house, and the number 13 as well. So she has she planted 13 trees which line the entrance of the house, and there are 13 drains in a kitchen sink. So Matt, you saw that when you were there.
I did. So there's 13 different holes in the same sink to let the water out?
Well, you know how, yes, you know, a drain has holes in it to keep like chunks of food from going down.
The filters had 13 holes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Got it. I just thought that was a really remarkably bad plumbing idea. I think we should.
Well, there's more of that to come as well. But Sarah just had this recurring theme of 13 throughout her house. She would even set her dining table every night for 13 guests. And these were spirit guests as well. So one of the biggest points of interest in the house is the so-called seance room too. And it said that she held seances there every midnight until about 2 a.m. in the morning. Obviously, it's a tautology there. And she has, and the hooks are still there. She's got 13 coat hooks for the 13 robes that she used as part of her rituals. She was holding these seances every day, and she was an incredibly reclusive woman. But at the same time, she had Harry Houdini visit the house, and he did a seance with her too. Isn't that nice?
It is. It's lovely.
Very nice.
So another story goes that the former U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt was a fan of Winchester products. In fact, a limited edition commemorative rifle had been named after him. And that one day he made an unannounced visit to the house, and a staff member opened the door who was unaccustomed to visitors and said to the president, "You're going to enter the house through the back entrance like the rest of the servants." So Roosevelt was so highly offended, he left and he never returned.
This sounds like the Andrew Jackson coming to the Bell Witch story. It seems weird.
Well, yeah, that wouldn't have transferred to this one, though, would it?
Yeah. It doesn't work like that. This is a true story. So in another account, Roosevelt requested a visit with Sarah, but he was just flatly refused. So it was said that she was an incredibly difficult mistress of the house, that she used to spy on her workers, and she paid them very little, and if they ever gossiped about her, she would immediately fire them. So she was really mean to them. And apparently some of her workers, too, said that she had the ability to walk through solid doors and walls, so which is kind of interesting, an interesting ghost story. And so she died September 5th, 1922, aged 82. So she did survive a lot longer than her other family members. And it was said that her will had been signed 13 times. I think there were 13 pages to the will as well. And it said that the moment that she died, the workers ceased building the house. So they just dropped all of their tools, and that half-hammered nails can still be found throughout the mansion too. And you can find those. When you go on the tour, you can see these half-hammered nails throughout the house. And so as soon as she passed, her staff went in search of a vault that was in her bedroom, and they cracked that open and they found another vault inside of that.
And 13 more vaults.
That's, yeah, I mean, you needed to embellish this.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that would have been a good story. But so they opened it up and they found the obituaries of her husband and daughter and locks of their hair as well.
Oh.
So, very sad. But
and as soon as they took those out, the safe was unlocked.
True or not. Nice.
Sorry. I don't want to spoil anything, but I just want to say historically, like when I read this story the first time, it all seemed very plausible because it's all right in the heart of the spiritualism movement. So yeah. The supernatural claims are one thing, but like the woman obsessed about the fear of the supernatural seems extremely plausible.
Oh, absolutely. We still have plenty of that in these days.
Yeah.
But the thing about spiritualism is it made complete sense. It was absolutely logical. There were no holes in any of those beliefs. And yet, the beliefs coming out of this story, they're worse than spiritualism because you've got you know, on the one side, she's kind of trying to confound the spirits and confuse them. And then the other half, she's trying to, mm-hmm. and the other side, she's trying to house them. And I think a lot more people died than, yeah, I mean, she needed to do a lot more work if she was going to house them. But the thing is if she was trying to house them, then why would it be so confusing? And if she was trying to confound them, doesn't she know that ghosts can walk through walls? So, you know.
So can she, sir.
Yeah, and so can she. So she should have extra knowledge to know that this isn't going to fool any ghost. They can just walk right through the wall and not have to worry about falling from the door to nowhere and things like that. So it's just like there's these mishmash is what it is. This mishmash of disparate beliefs or claims.
Yeah,
that just they don't make sense. And yet, you know, when we were there, it was. I mean, you were standing in line to go through this place. Like it was a Disneyland attraction. Mm-hmm. You know, people want this more than they do checking out this really interesting house. They want the stories. And
when we went there, we had to line up for a couple of hours to get in for a tour. It was that popular.
Wow.
To this day.
What does it cost to go see it, or roughly? Or, you know.
Oh, boy.
In 1839 money. It was probably about $1,000, I think.
Oh, I could check the tickets because I could buy them online.
Well, it's about, I think it was about $50 the last time we went there. You can do a tour of just the house, or you can also do a tour of the grounds and the kind of farmland and everything too. And they do ghost tours as well around Halloween and flashlight tours. That kind of thing. So they're all different prices, but it is not cheap. It's an expensive tour that only lasts about an hour.
And if you want to do a ghost hunt there, that's where they're really cashing in.
Let's talk about the ghost stories. I just wanted to close off on the whole vault thing to say that Sarah had stored these keepsakes and she was very concerned that someone was going to use those against her in a curse. So that's why she kept these locks of hair in multiple vaults, probably 13 of them. So, yes, there are a lot of ghost stories surrounding the place, and it's interesting because when you go there on a tour, it is not a ghost tour. But a lot of people have claimed that they've experienced all different kinds of paranormal activity while they've been there, and certainly the place does not shy away from promoting these stories. If you go to their website, you can enter sightings that you've experienced or things that have happened to you when you've been there. People do submit their ghost stories. So they really do encourage this part of the folklore. And there have been a number of ghost shows that have gone to the Winchester Mystery House. And as Matt said, it can get pretty expensive to go there because indemnity and insurance and things like that. I think I've heard that it's about $10,000 to go through there to do a ghost hunt. I'm sure that they get people requesting that they can do an investigation there all the time. But you get shows like Ghost Adventures, Ghost Hunters, Most Haunted, Ghost Brothers, and BuzzFeed have been there and done shows. But there are a lot of claims of phenomena taking place there. Things like cold spots and ghostly lights and phantom footsteps. People hearing phantom organ music in the ballroom. Now, there's a chandelier in the ballroom too, and there are 13 lights in the chandelier. So, again, you've got that 13 motif throughout the house. People hear things like the sound of ghostly nails falling to the ground or nails being hammered into the walls, and they'll see the ghosts of people who used to work there, like carpenters and maids, and then they'll see photographs of former staff on the walls and say, oh, that's the ghost that I saw, and be able to identify them. Also, people will see the ghosts of victims of the Winchester rifle. And Sylvia Brown was actually there. I think it could have been back in the 1980s, and she conducted a seance at the house, and she was able to confirm that there was a curse placed upon Sarah. And she also saw the spirit of Sarah. And she saw the ghosts of fallen soldiers from the Civil War who live in the house.
Bless your heart.
Fair enough.
But yeah, people do experience all kinds of things. They say that they can smell Sarah's perfume, but I don't think we have on record what perfume she actually wore.
Gunpowder and molasses.
Possibly. That they can smell her cooking chicken soup from the kitchen. And people also say that they hear their name being called and that they hear whispers or screams. People feel like they're pushed or the hair is pulled. So you have tons of these experiences. Matt, did you experience anything when you were there?
No.
Hunger?
I think I got hungry at one point.
I'm looking at the website. They've added, they have an axe throwing experience at the stables now and a Houdini escape room. So, you know, clearly they're adding on just in case you don't have a supernatural experience. There's a few other things to try.
Yeah, definitely.
Perfect.
So that is the folklore in a nutshell. And that's what you, if you go and Google this topic, these are the stories that you'll read about. If you look this up on YouTube, these are the stories that you're going to hear about. This is what everyone is being told. And so I think it's time to look at the true story behind this and to look at the history and to bust some of these myths.
Yeah. I would say your book was probably the first time I had read a deep dive into the actual history. So, and again, I definitely recommend people pick it up. It goes pretty deep in lots of other cases too, like the Myrtles. So,
yeah, well, thank you. And there has been a lot of interest in the Winchester Mystery House of late. And that's why I thought, you know, we haven't tackled this topic before on Monster Talk. I have been interviewed about it many times and have written about it and done a lot of research. So it's absolutely time for us to do a show on this.
Sarah Winchester, not quite what she was made out to be?
Absolutely not. No, that once you really start peeling back the layers of the folklore, the story just completely falls apart. And as you said, when I first heard about this story, it seemed plausible, not the ghosts and this and that, but certainly the aspects of her being a haunted woman and thinking that she had this curse placed upon her. And I will admit that in early articles that I wrote about this topic, I retold the story and I came up with, for me, plausible, natural explanations for why she believed these things. And then I came across a fantastic book. I think it's absolutely the best resource that's out there, a book by Mary Jo Ignoffo. She's a historian. She wrote a book called Captive of the Labyrinth. And she really just busts this whole story open. So this is, there are certainly things that I've researched myself too, but she really opened this up and was able to explain a lot of the claims for this story. So Sarah Winchester, a lot of people actually knew her as Sally. That was her nickname during her life. Aunt Sally as well, because she had sisters and nieces and nephews. So she was very well liked. I'm going to get into that. So it's very unlikely anyway that she had a guilty conscience. So as Blake's kind of touched upon too, the Winchester Company didn't only make guns. Those were one of the many kinds of items that the Winchester Company made, that they were also, they started their business in making men's business shirts. And then they branched out into other areas. They made a lot of household items like irons and silverware and flashlights and garden tools and even roller skates and, of course, fruit. So she was mostly known for the orchards that she had on the property there, and they grew apples and plums and apricots and almonds and walnuts, and these were all sold under her packing label.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So one of the big myths to bust is that it appears that there was no psychic, that there's no record of her ever meeting with any kind of psychic. And the name Adam Koons first appears in a 1967 book by a woman named Susie Smith. So, yeah, there's just no information stating that she believed in psychics or that she ever visited a psychic. So she had actually moved to the West Coast because she wanted to start afresh, and I think she already had some family members there too. She wanted to be closer to them and also had plans to bring her family to the West Coast and they could just all, you know, start their lives there. So when she built the house, as I said, obviously it wasn't called the Winchester Mystery House. So she'd named it Lanada Villa. Excuse my Spanish, it's terrible. So that's Spanish for house on the flatland. And the reason she named it this was that the valley reminded her of the Lanada Alavesa in the Pyrenees. She visited there with her husband in better times. So I think one of the most interesting things about this is that she built this house in a style that was really popular of that day. And there were other people who had built these oversized and unique houses. It was a real trend of the time for the wealthy. And there were several other people of similar social standing who undertook projects on a similar scale to that. So we look at that house now and it's really one of the last ones standing. We'll also talk about the Hayes Mansion too. That's a house which is still around, which is in a similar style. But she had a very keen interest in architecture and she subscribed to architectural journals and she drafted many of the plans and she came from a family of woodworkers as well. And she used to share some projects with her husband. So she, Blake, you'll be interested in this. She loved technology. So she'd incorporated many features that people at the time found to be strange. Things like elevators and indoor plumbing, bathrooms and kitchens that were designed to conserve water. So she was really ahead of her time.
Yeah, in many ways. I think it's interesting to think about she had what would effectively to us be unlimited resources and a great deal of curiosity. And she could try out things that you might think about for your house, but can't because you don't have the free resources, the time, the money. If you could just do whatever comes to your mind, your house might start to look a little weird too, you know? But she's also just trying out stuff, you know? It's fabulous. And I think you're probably going to cover this, but she was also providing employment at a time when it was hard to come by.
Yeah, we'll totally get into that.
Yeah.
And it just makes me think of weird people with money today, like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and all the kinds of things that they do.
Yep. So it was just a matter of time before she had to build a rocket. That's what we do.
Yeah, that was her rocket. But by all accounts, she was an incredibly intelligent woman and that when she was a child, she'd learned, she was a polyglot and she could speak multiple languages and she was really great at mathematics and science and musical composition and was considered at the time to be a child prodigy. So people really undersell her to say that she used automatic writing to receive construction plans from the spirits.
Wow. Yeah.
And that kind of thing. But she was very reclusive and she didn't, even with all of her money, she didn't host social events and she didn't attend society events. So this kind of thing really made her the subject of a lot of gossip. She was also quite shy. She'd lost most of her teeth and she wore a veil and she had rheumatoid arthritis too.
Ew.
That seriously affected her hands and feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that explains another feature in the house, these switchback stairs or easy risers. She was only 4'10" in height as well.
Wow.
So, those were built for her convenience. But when I was there, they seriously told us that these stairs were designed to slow down the spirits as they chased her.
That's not how those work. Yeah.
Yeah, that would work.
Yeah, but I don't think they said that the time that you were there with me, Matt, but I remember hearing from them.
They actually, I think they did say that, or they said something of that nature. There was a paranormal reason that these stairs were so low, and they were going to confuse the ghosts and trip them up and everything, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, ridiculous that the people believe this and retell it as well. But then you're being told that from the source. So where did all of these stories come from? Well, there are a couple of avenues for that. So as I said, she was the subject of much gossip during her life. And in around 1895, there was an article that came out in the San Jose Mercury Herald. And it started a lot of rumors. So this article was titled, "A Woman Who Thinks She Will Die When Her House Is Built." And the legends really grew from there. So in this article, she was, you know, so these are the days of yellow journalism as well. Blake, we've talked about this on the show.
We have. And yellow journalism is associated with lots of outrageous lies buried in sometimes some truth. Mm-hmm. But you've got the Hearst newspapers against the Pulitzer papers, if I remember correctly. I think that was the big rivalry. But and I think if I remember correctly, it was called yellow journalism because one of the papers published a comic book strip or comic strip called The Yellow Kid, which was a leading sort of it was a very popular comic strip at the time. So, yellow journalism, not a glorious time for journalism, but very memorable in American history.
Absolutely, yeah. And so in this article, she was accused of being really strange and just having way too much money and being excessive in everything that she was doing. And they also cast her as the conscience of the Winchester Repeating Arms Company, that she was shouldering responsibility for the numerous deaths caused by the guns. They said that she was mentally ill. Another amazing story that they said is that she had a houseboat in Burlingame, and that was true. But the press speculated wildly that she'd feared a flood of biblical proportions. And so she built her own new Noah's Ark.
Do you get the feeling that maybe part of this is it was a time when women were being suppressed a lot in general. And then here's this incredibly powerful woman who largely doesn't have a voice. I mean, she's doing things in the community, but she's not doing her own press. And so people could just make up whatever they want to about her. And I imagine people are jealous because, good Lord, she's rich. And I'm no fan of Elon Musk, but a lot of the stuff that's said about him and Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos is entirely sour grapes. It's people who really don't like to see that much concentrated wealth. And I get that, and I understand the motivation, but they don't need to make up the stories that they make up. But they do it anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah. But there's some irony here. So she is, Sarah Winchester is often conflated with a faith healer by the name of Mary Folsom Hayes Chenoweth. And she had founded the True Life Church, so in the days of spiritualism. But the irony here is that her sons, Everest and Jay Hayes, owned this newspaper. So this is really strange that this story in some regards is about their mother. Their mother is a spiritualist. Their mother set up this church, and she built a very similar house to the Hayes Mansion in San Jose. I believe at one point it had maybe 100 rooms, and then there was a fire. So they rebuilt it in this kind of Mediterranean style. And to this day, it has about 60 plus rooms.
Wow.
So again, we're talking about these really unique, oversized houses, but this was a building trend of the time. So it wasn't only Sarah Winchester who was building her house. There were neighbors who were building these houses and then accusing her of having too much money and spending excessively and building crazy houses.
Well, this is a weird question, but how was the temperature there? I mean, a house that big seems like, especially built before central air, seems like it'd be really hard to keep it temperature controlled.
The climate, for the most part, I mean, the Bay Area has, certainly in San Francisco, it just chills due to the bone, the winds and the cold there. But you've got just various parts that are cooler than others. So I used to live in Berkeley and used to get these beautiful breezes that would come in from the bay. Mm. But if you would drive to Walnut Creek, it suddenly hit this wall where it was, you know, 110 degrees in the shade. And so, yeah, you've got these weird microclimates. But down in San Jose, it can certainly get hot. And I believe that Sarah Winchester was a very kindly employer, so she wasn't this mean mistress that she was made out to be. And on extremely hot days, she would give her staff the day off. But certainly with a big, airy place like that, I mean, for the most part, the climate there is very mild. I mean, we're talking 60s and 70s.
You know, I guess that makes sense for orchards to be functional, right? So, yeah.
Good climate for that kind of thing. Yeah. But, you know, basically Sarah had these stories written about her, but they were really about Mary Hayes Chenoweth and not about her. So it's just very strange that this would happen. And I don't know much about the history of why they did that. But Sarah was not a spiritualist, and her personal companion and secretary, who was with her until her death, denied that her boss was a spiritualist and said that she was a practicing Episcopalian.
Hmm. It's like ominous. Hmm, Episcopalian, I see. What?
Yeah. But mediums were very popular in those days. This was the heyday of spiritualism. San Jose had a really active and open community of spiritualists, including Leland Stanford, like.
Yeah, I believe I've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, these beliefs were absolutely around. So, again, something plausible. Perhaps she did believe in these things and she wasn't speaking out against all these claims made against her either. I mean, surprising she didn't sue them at the time. Nowadays, that would be done.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. Like, my impression of her is that She, in a lot of ways, rose above this and was doing things that she felt were right. But, I, you know, without her diaries or something, it's hard to say, right? So,
well, that's the thing. I mean, she did leave a wealth of evidence behind. She left letters. She left all kinds of legal documents. And those are explored by Mary Jo Ignoffo in her book. So we do have all of this correspondence and accounts of people who knew her as well.
Oh, excellent.
So that's why we're able to really prize this open. But you know, for example,
we should put links to that in the show notes too, as well, by the way. So your book and hers, and like, so people want to dig deeper. Clearly there's a lot to learn here. This is interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And so, for example, the seance room, was not a seance room. It was a bedroom that was used by various staff, and, the people who now own the house added the coat hooks.
Isn't any seance room one nap away from being a bedroom? And isn't any bedroom one seance away from being a seance room?
When you put it that way, yeah. So Harry Houdini did visit the house. That part is true, but the dates are inaccurate. So he didn't turn up and do a seance with her. He visited the place after her death in 1924. So
that's right. I remember that. Not that I was there. I mean, I don't remember that.
So when you go on the tour, so Matt, you will remember this, that there are a lot of really weird features in the house that we've talked about. And there's a natural explanation for this. A lot of these were a direct result of the San Francisco earthquake, which hit April 18th, 1906. So at the time, floors collapsed and pipes were left sticking out of the house and chimneys and rooms were sealed off. So the original house had seven stories and these were reduced down to three stories. So the paranormal theory, though, is that the spirits were displeased with her handiwork because it appeared that she was nearing completion of the house. So they're the ones who caused the 1906 earthquake.
Hmm.
But you didn't know that.
From seven stories to three stories, nature is a cruel editor.
It is indeed. So when this happened, when the earthquake hit, she considered just demolishing the house. And in the end, portions were sealed off instead. And rather than rebuilding the place, they just made it as safe as they possibly could. And when you go through today, you'll see sections where they stopped working, sections that are sealed off, and all of these, you know, very peculiar features in the house that have these actual explanations. So the stairway to nowhere once led to an upper floor, and the door to nowhere led out to a balcony. So even Sarah herself, she saw the place after the earthquake, and she said it looked as though it had been built by a crazy person. So she was very aware and mindful of how she was being seen by people. Some people say, too, that she had a quirky sense of humor.
Yeah. I was just saying, that's a big insight that some of these features were damaged by earthquake and left looking bizarre. You know, that's... This story kind of infuriates me, and I got kind of mad when I read your write-up on it, because it's like, wow, this woman sounds pretty awesome, and she's gotten the bad end of history on her.
Totally.
Absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, we'll talk about that more in a second, too, but some people say that she had a really quirky sense of humor. If you go on YouTube, you can find some very old interviews with people who knew her children, or people who were children at the time, and speak very highly of her. And some people say that she had a quirky sense of humor, and she just kind of left some of these features behind as artifacts because she thought it was funny. So there's a possibility too. It's certainly more plausible than the whole haunting curse theory. So, but another twist to this too, and I've already touched upon this, and that is that a lot of these quirky features were added in after her death by the new owners. So according to her former carpenter, his name was James Perkins, he said the more irregular features which have made the house a world-famed oddity were built after Mrs. Winchester's death.
Hmm. More of those aftermarket modifications we were talking about. What?
Yeah.
So the construction as well, it was not 24/7. It stopped and it started over the years. And Sarah didn't even live in the house after the earthquake. The last 15 years or so of her life, she lived in nearby Atherton. And she had about a dozen homes in the Bay Area. So she had the houseboat in Burlingame, house in Atherton, and the now, as we know it, the Winchester Mystery House, but she didn't actually live there. But she spent a lot of her money not only on the house, yes, she spent a great deal of money on that, but also on philanthropy and on her family. She had her sisters and their children, and she founded the William Wirt Winchester Hospital, which was for tuberculosis. It's now the Veterans Hospital in West Haven, Connecticut.
Wow.
So she was really very generous, giving a lot of her money away, and just didn't get the credit for it. But as for the house, she really built it as a hobby. I think that it made her feel like she was closer to her husband because of his interest in building and coming from a family of woodworkers as well. And as Blake touched upon, there was a lot of economic hardship in the late 19th century. And Sarah was very kindly trying to do her bit to keep construction workers and other staff employed. So she paid them very handsomely in the day, more than other places were paying these kinds of staff. So she was really doing it out of the kindness of her heart. She wasn't this mean boss that she's put up to be. But the place was purchased and is still in the hands of the same family, the Brown family, John H. Brown. He had owned theme parks and designed roller coasters. So I think you really have this kind of theme park theme of the house nowadays. So he's really maintained that. Apparently, he had designed a roller coaster and a woman was killed riding it. And so he was trying to kind of divert attention away from that by buying the Winchester Mystery House and turning it into this kind of amusement park that it is today. So he bought it and he opened it up to the public. And very strangely, a lot of stories of hauntings and seances appeared after her death. And so he was really cultivating these stories. And again, they're told to this day. So there are books and movies, and there's even a musical about Sarah Winchester, and these create a lot more layers of fiction, and they keep retelling these stories. They've really damaged her reputation over the years, and Sarah was and is very misunderstood. So I think it's important that we get to the bottom of this and read a book like Mary Jo Agnoffo's book, Captive of the Labyrinth, and I cover a lot of this in my chapter as well in Haunting America. But to get a more accurate portrayal of her life and times. There's also a quote from her lawyer His name was Samuel Lieb, and he said that Sarah was a sane and clear-headed woman as I've ever known. She had a better grasp of business and financial affairs than most men. So when you get these glimpses of people who knew her and worked with her, it really paints a very different picture to the one that we're told when we visit the house or when we do a little bit of superficial digging into the stories.
Yeah. You've got a supernatural story that sounds plausible, but is now that you've dug into it, there's basically nothing to it. And it's one of those, like, I mean, there's nothing inherently implausible about a woman becoming overwhelmed by guilt and being caught up in spiritualism, right? But it's also not true. So it's like, yeah, it's not implausible, but unless you question it and like look to see where it comes from, it's completely sticky. And I mean, it dominates all the web pages about the site. And like you say, there's now this sort of parallel / adjacent supernatural stuff that's been glommed onto it. Like as people have been having experiences, because clearly if her story is true, then if you were inclined to believe in such things, then of course a place that was designed to trap spirits would have, you know, trapped spirits. And so therefore it's like you're completely primed to expect the paranormal. It's just fascinating. They built a paranormal hotspot entirely from a structure made of poo-poo. Working on that clean title for a tag. It's like...
And again, I'll admit that when I first heard the story, I just started repeating this story and trying to find explanations to justify why she might have thought this way, why she might have done the things that she did. But you just dig a little deeper and you'll find that this is just completely made up.
I think one of the big problems is you get this character, Adam Koons. If somebody writes about this person as if it's fact, you don't really think, oh, this person's, you know, there's a real possibility this person's completely made up.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really think that way. If it's, you know, it's imprint, this person existed, blah, blah, blah. Well, then you kind of take
it as... so much detail.
If you pardon the phrase, you take it as gospel. And it's not something you think about doing because we don't question, you know, not very many of us have gone and done the research to actually see that Sarah Winchester actually existed. We just believe it when people tell us that she existed. You know, we are not going down and looking up the documentation or all this kind of stuff. So when someone tells us that Adam Koons is a real person, we're also not going to see the documentation that that's true. And so we just take it on faith that this guy is real and she went and visited him and now she's got all these crazy thoughts in her head. Now we're all thinking, of course, this guy's a fraud telling her this stuff and he was probably just getting money from her. We don't think about the fact that he never even existed.
Yeah, exactly. We can totally imagine a keeping her on the hook, you know, milking her for cash, you know, being friends with a local builder, making sure that there's somebody always getting little grifts on the side. Like I can imagine an entire infrastructure of manipulation and ripoff, and it's just not there. It's just not real.
Yeah. But Matt, you'll remember too when we went to the Myrtles plantation in Louisiana, in St. Francisville. When you ask questions, they'll say, oh, yes, we have evidence for this. There's the fellow who used to own the building. They'll talk about his diaries and how they're available at the local library. So they have all of these things to kind of shut you down if you have questions. So we went to the local library and we asked about this and we spoke with the head librarian there, and there was absolutely... There's no diary, no evidence of any kinds of letters of this particular person to support these claims. But these are the kinds of bits of information, false information, that you'll be handed at places like the Myrtles Plantation and the Winchester Mystery House. They'll just keep you. If you ask questions, they'll say, oh, no, there's proof of this. And we have this, and it's locked away, I guess, in the vault with the locks of hair as well.
Yes.
You know, we have this proof and this evidence to support all of the things that we're saying. But it's incredible when you go on the tour because they're always conducted by teenagers and they're reciting this script in a very robotic fashion. And there's no room for questions, really. They're just telling you these things and you're leaving the place and retelling these stories. It's quite a thing that they have going.
Yeah. It's a bizarre thing to witness, you know, and it is so robotic the way they're just, you know, they've memorized their script and there's really no room for questions. This is just what it is. I'm reading to you from the Bible. Here it is. You don't ask questions, you know, and that's kind of what's going on here. And, you know, as you're going through it, there's a lot of things you're like, why? You know, you pass by this one room where there are several sort of old fashioned brooms standing up in the middle of the room. And it's really eerie when you walk by this. You see these things, they look like they're balancing. Obviously, they're affixed there somehow. But why? Why would they do that? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. But it just leaves you unsettled as you walk by it because you're kind of rushed by it. You don't get to go up and look at anything. You're just kind of rushed by these bizarre broomsticks standing in the middle of a room, you know?
Is it, or they decorated by brooms to go?
Yes. Nice. Just brooms.
But the whole 13 thing is a fabrication, and there's a like a big shrub, example of papyri, and they've turned it into the number 13. And so all of this stuff has been added. Matt, do you want to tell everyone about the chandelier?
Oh, yeah, it's so convincing. There's this chandelier that has like these gas jets for the flames. And supposedly when it had arrived, it only had 12. And she was not happy about that at all. So she had another one added. And this very, you know, rich woman who you go through the rest of the house and there's a lot of. I don't know if I'd call it perfection, but there's a lot of really great handiwork, you know, throughout the house. But this chandelier has this like 13th gas jet just like stuck on at a bizarre angle. Like, you know, they just kind of stuck it there and that's going to make her happy. It's so obvious that it was added afterwards.
So you're saying that the as far as this being made up or this sort of gaslighting is a prime example?
Yes.
Prime example.
Well, and we handed you that one, didn't we?
Another thing that, Matt, we've encountered in a lot of these supposedly haunted places too are that they've got contemporary mirrors and paintings on the walls and, chandeliers that they're saying, oh, this was this beautiful antique that, you know, period style.
This is the period iPhone that she used to use for.
Exactly.
But this particular, I'm thinking about the haunted mirror at the Myrtle's plantation that they're claiming that this mirror is 200 years old. And to look at the chandelier, there's not a fine quality chandelier that was handmade in Germany 200 years ago. I mean, this is just a modern, something they picked up from Home Depot, and just tack this extra light onto and just telling people that this is her handiwork. And it's offensive. I mean, this is a highly intelligent woman, and they're just making her out to be this mad person, and it's a real slight on her character.
Totally agree.
Yeah, and I'm trying not to make a pun about her being 4'10" and slight. Yeah.
you didn't try very hard.
We've given you a lot of material to work with. You don't have to go for the low-hanging stuff.
I'm restraining myself. Yeah, I'm like Houdini. I'm restraining myself.
But it is a fascinating story, and I just think it's really important to talk about this and to do shows like this and to get the truth out there, because it's really we're dealing with a lot of folklore that's overshadowing the truth.
Yeah, this is the kind of folklore or legend that's insidious because it seems so plausible, and yet it's also harmful in that it destroys the reputation of a person who sounds like they deserve a very close second look, you know, historically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, they deserve better than this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the good news is that, you know, we have podcasts like this one and books that are out there, like Captive of the Labyrinth, that tell the truth. And I think that that's just what we need to disseminate, the truth.
Yes, I agree. All right.
Yeah. So I'm glad that we talked about this because, again, I've been interviewed about this topic so many times, and I thought we've got to do an episode on this. And I think to the point where you and I had thought that maybe we'd already done one.
Well, we definitely talked about it before, but we didn't give it this level of coverage at all, right? So I think we've mentioned it, I believe, on two episodes, but this is the first, as far as I know, the first full episode entirely dedicated to this topic.
Well, Matt was suggesting too that we should do an episode of Debased on a True Story and look at the movie.
Oh, that'll make that Winchester Repeaters.
There we go. We got a final one in there.
That's known as the pun that won the West. Yeah.
Wow. I suddenly have to go to the bathroom.
On that note, I think we've better end this episode.
I agree.
Nothing more to say.
All right. That's
excellent.
Thanks,
guys, for joining me to talk about this. This topic's near and dear to my heart, I think, because it's just such an interesting combination of folklore and history. And another one of those stories that I've been fascinated by since I was a kid. And just to think, you know, I was an adult before I knew the true story, and just really believed in all of the myths for the longest time there. And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this episode are only aware of the myths.
Exactly.
And it's, I think that the big lesson is, again, in the true definition of skepticism, which is don't take things at face value. And the problem that we all were faced with on this one is we were given the choice of the supernatural explanation being real, or her being kind of crazy being real. And those were the only two options we were kind of given. So we went with the more probable one, not realizing that there was an even more probable one reading.
It's the old false dichotomy. And you're absolutely right. It's just you got to question your assumptions, because frequently, and that I'm always, or so far, I've always been pleasantly surprised when I discover that something I took for true is completely wrong. It's fascinating to me. I love having my world shook a little bit. It's nice. So, yeah.
Oh,
I agree.
Us too. Yeah. I mean, that's really solving a mystery. Yeah.
Yep.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. You've been listening to a discussion with Karen Stolzno, Matt Baxter, and me about the many convoluted and unfortunate legends surrounding the Winchester Mystery House. Since I don't get to do my visit before this episode actually goes live, I'll try and add some supplementary photos to the show notes on our website at monstertalk.org once I'm done visiting this week. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Big Picture Science, Good Job Brain, and My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. If you'd like to advertise on the show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. As always, thank you for making Monster Talk a part of your listening life. We'll be right back.
This has been a Monster House presentation.